So, I apologize, I too have a prepubescent teenage boy voice right now. And it will crack, but whatever. So I'm going to read from a portion of my prose thesis that I've never read aloud before either. So I'm excited. Is Charlie Apple here? Darn. He actually inspired me to write this accidentally when he told me that when he played tag in elementary school, he always used to play on the girls' side. This is the explanation of it's like the history of the town that I write about for my prose thesis, and it's the explanation of the curse that is now like affecting them. So it's just sort of like a parable, I suppose. The Huitlarocos were a small band of what we would now call kinfolk, and they lived in a time when the weather was as irregular as the chance of eating a filling meal, and the only clothes around were made with animal skins and woven twine nimble-fingered by the women with the keenest eyes. During the Ice Age era, these haggard people, these Huitlarocos, weary walked themselves over the frozen continent shelf that made itself their cheerless blight. They walked themselves over and walked themselves lost until they found a new land, a land whose warmth melted a straight path through the ocean. In hewn boats of the oaken variety, the Huitlarocos rode to a found place we now call Paisley Ridge, veritably warmer than their original place of residence and abounding with the natural green that fills bellies full. There was bloom everywhere and low heaves of hills, so much so that they couldn't bring their eyes to look further, couldn't bring their feet to trudge past. They succeeded quite simply. The men began building huts from dried and bleached grasses and the clay-red soil that clung to the hillsides with the goats and coyotes and scarlet oak and river birch. They settled easily. The land seemed to welcome them in. Every seed they planted grew as tall as their leader, a Hode, whose strides were twice as long as any man's in the area and whose arms could encircle any tree's entire trunk. And the wind whispered through the new lands in an untalkable language they worked to translate into aboundfuls. The women worked mainly in the rows and rows of lined crop, growing food of the most colorful variety, squash that twisted and rippled into the largest of gourds, beans that popped clean from their shells like delivery, and corn whose silk was braided into all the small girls' hair and entwined into strings for instruments. Theirs was a simple life, a worship of the land and firmament in equal measure. Their language changed with the landscape, and soon there were words that we would take to later mean sunset and crescent, the beginning of words that roll off the tongue as easily as languid, the terms we developed closer to our time to explain the lazed pauses in between seasons, the days spent sitting around and picking the things between our teeth. However, at the start, there were few people in the tribe and fewer days of rest. When the third generation came round, one of the boys was different. Not in the favorable way some difference that teaches you how to question, but the plain, unsettling, and disruptive kind. The mother was Ahode's son's wife, and she went by the name Unip. She was, without quarrel, the most wanted kind of woman, waved and dark hair, broad hips, a strong back, and a sharp mind. She had spent all her free time for the last years weaving garlands to adorn her house so it always smelled of dried flowers and had with it an intimidating beauty that its owner matched. When Ahode's son, also named Ahode, took Unip as his, the tribe all approved, painted the two young people's faces, and blessed their bodies for the child that was to come. The couple exchanged nervous words to each other, understanding but still shy. Ahode was unsure if he wanted to become tribe leader, and Unip only knew that she wanted to give him children. Children that would be as wondrous as the tribe saw the two of them. Unip birthed two sons, the older of which had her delicately feminine nose and lips. He struck people with his beauty, his pale eyes and dark skin, and she loved him more than her other son and husband together. In the yellow day and the kernel sky night, it is said the most loved son didn't speak to anyone besides his mother. He rarely left his home. It wasn't until about his ninth year on this earth, when the Huitlarocos boys and girls are separated to each begin learning their tasks, that Unip's eldest son, a boy who went by the name Shaw, began interacting with the rest of us proper. This was when the difference became all too apparent to the Huitlarocos, maybe because he hadn't done much mingling or playing with the other kids before that, maybe because he just didn't think the same as the rest of the Paisley Ridge residents. He didn't seem to grasp the difference between girl and boy tasks just right. When the kids were divided up every morning, Shaw would move himself over to the girls' side, would take up happily only the girls' responsibilities. So he would go pick corn from the green wide land rather than churn the soil, would milk the cows rather than bind the bulls, and as if to insist on this reapportioning, he began to dress in girl clothes too. Occasionally, because of his slender waist and fine cheeks, no one would notice until past midday, realize the chief's son was again with the girls, long skirt, hair curved into a braid at the peak of his head. The older women would call Ahodi out to the field to scold the young man. The girls watched as Ahodi, the now mighty leader, big as his paw, struck his son clean. The girls all watched and later cried to their mas and pas, telling them of the chief, the large chief's ire, whose blow moved his son back feet from his original standing place. Ahodi's strike reverberated around the small tribe, and before the next day's dawn, everyone knew. Yunip cried, as she often did, fearing that it was her fault for loving her son too much, or else for entering into the pragmatic kind of marriage. Ahodi was not the kind of man she wanted Shaw to grow into, and Yunip had invented the word compassion to explain her desires, had whispered it into Shaw's open ears as he slept. Perhaps she had cast her son this way. He took to wearing only the longer skirts of the women, refused to wear the headdress every boy was given at 13, and Yunip, not knowing what to do, made him the most beautiful bows and intricate arrows so he would desire to go elk hunting with his younger brother and the other soon becoming men. He refused. She cut her hair short to signify her mourning and hung the lock above their door, stripping down all the flowers, burned all Shaw's dolls. She stopped talking. It was after months of Yunip's sealed silence that she found the small oak box filled with bits of face coal nestled into Shaw's bedding. Yunip had taught Shaw that the Huitlarocos land was heaven, a heaven that allowed for freedom. As she strode over to the longhouse where she knew he'd be, weaving baskets despite her and her husband's pleas that he collect water from the ice lake in the land one hillside over, she felt the cool air pull on the small hairs on her back. Perhaps she had lied to him about Paisley Ridge. Shaw was not, though, weaving. Shaw was not in the field stringing together new ropes of flowers to adorn their house, nor was her son with his father learning to draw out the land and understand its bends. Yunip's heart beat faster. She bit her lip and pulled blood. Combing her mind, she knew of one final place where Shaw might be, a small cave created from fell trees just beyond their home. When he was a small boy, they would make wolf howls together there and pretend to be the animals Ahodi brought back skinned and menacing, teeth sharp and eyes only socket. Shaw hadn't realized it was his mother until after he had stuck the whittled piece of oak from his back pocket directly and firmly into her soft stomach. He hadn't realized how deep the makeshift knife had drove its sheath. She looked up, eyes darting from him, unrecognizable in a long skirt, eyes and cheekbones smeared with dark charcoal, as gorgeous as the land in full bloom. Eyes darting from him to the boy she had seen him tangled with, the two boys both had a look of caughtness, guilt filling their bodies and changing their posture, and the boy's love dropped like the knife between them. And Yunip dropped too, blood pooling around her. Thank you.